Jeff Abala with you here, 720 WGN, 1208 AM. Happy Saturday morning, everybody. Thanks for staying up late with us. We're here until 1 o'clock. Bitcoin has been in the news quite a bit lately. It's in the news a lot because of the fluctuations and what it's worth. I imagine that most of you are like me. They're like, oh, yeah, Bitcoin. I know what Bitcoin. I don't understand what the hell Bitcoin is. And I never will. I've done this interview before. People have tried to explain this to me. But I kind of gave up on it. But then this story about this guy, Stephen Thomas, lives in San Francisco, has Bitcoin, has a digital wallet of 7,002 Bitcoins. He has it in a hard drive. So I guess basically you just have this currency virtually, which is insane, but it's still worth something, right? Which I guess, you know what, in reality, and we'll ask Lamont Black, our guest, about this in a minute. I guess the paper we hold is just virtual. It's just representation of it anyways. The bill I have in my hand that's green isn't truly worth anything, right? It's just a piece of paper. It's what it represents. So I guess if I look at it that way, maybe I'm going to bring myself around on this. Anyways, this guy, he's got 7,002 of these digital coins. He's got them in a hard drive. And he's got it password protected. He forgot the password. This is some insane hard drive where you can't just figure out how to get into it. After 10 attempts, 10 wrong attempts, it will lock up forever. And this guy will lose his 7,002 digital coins. You're thinking, what? 7,002 digital coins? What's the big deal? Well, 10 years ago when he put it in there, they were worth around $2 to $6 at the time. So you're thinking, well, $42,000 worth, that's nothing to shake your head at. Problem is now they're worth like around $39,000. So if he locks this thing out, he's going to lose $277-ish million. Can you imagine? You forgot your password and now you're going to lose $277 million. Lamont Black is an associate professor of finance in the Dryhouse College of Business at DePaul University in Chicago. He was kind enough to jump on the phone with us tonight and try to walk me through life, or at least the idea of Bitcoin. Hey, Lamont, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well, Matt. It's great to be on the show.
Thank you so much for joining us. I do appreciate it. I know I'm being a little flip about this, but is Bitcoin as hard to understand as I think it is? I think a lot of us are like, Bitcoin, we might pretend to nod our heads, but it's one of those things where you might as well be doing brain surgery on me for all I know of what you're talking about.
Yeah, you're right. That's not the easiest thing to understand. And I try and explain it to my students, and some of them, they totally get into it, and others still shake their heads, and it doesn't make sense. So you're not alone.
Well, is it somewhat how I just described that? I guess if I look at it, you know, it's this virtual currency. It's locked in a hard drive, and then I lost the key, so I'm never going to get it. But I guess when I hand a dollar bill over to somebody, that dollar bill isn't truly worth anything. It's a piece of paper, so it's what that dollar bill represents. Is that how I could sort of look at cryptocurrency?
Yeah, you know, one reason I think cryptocurrency or Bitcoin are so interesting is because I do think this is kind of the evolution of money over time. If you think back to, you know, the history of money, we used to think of money as like gold or other types of precious metals. Then we started developing coins that we could carry around in our pockets. And then as you talked about, we started printing paper as representations of money. And so now that we live in the internet age, it's not surprising that we're talking about digital monies, but it is still hard for some people to grasp because it just doesn't seem like real money. But, Bitcoin is an electronic version of cash. I think what's really radically different about it is it's not connected to any government or any bank, and that's really what makes it different from what we're used to.
Well, we used to hear about people mining Bitcoin, and so I guess that was just a takeoff on the phrase of mining for gold. What did that mean when people were mining Bitcoin?
So Bitcoin is based on a technology called blockchain, and what I would encourage your listeners to look into is to try and understand blockchain, because if you can understand blockchain, you've gone a long way towards understanding Bitcoin. And blockchain is what's called a distributed ledger technology. And what's most important about that is we're not using banks to keep track of our accounts or our digital wallets. we're using a shared ledger. And what's especially unique about this is it's a ledger that everyone can see. So we have this public ledger that is keeping track of all these digital wallets in this Bitcoin network. And the real trick is, how do you agree on keeping track of what's in the ledger? So if somebody wants to buy or sell Bitcoin and move it from one wallet to another, who do we need to sort of verify that that transaction is legitimate? And that's the process of mining. So mining is the process of the blockchain being updated, and it's these miners that are solving this encryption problem in order to verify that the money is in this wallet, and we are now moving it to this wallet, and they are updating that public distributed ledger.
Okay.
How'd I do?
So the guys that are mining it, are they making money for doing this? Is that a job then? And who's paying them?
They are. So I wouldn't necessarily think of it as like a cut of the transaction. It's more like they are receiving additional Bitcoin in this process. And part of that's really necessary in order to incentivize them to provide this service. So if you think about, you know, in our traditional way of doing electronic payments, we have these other financial institutions and these card networks like Visa and MasterCard that provide this electronic payment service, and they receive transaction fees. You could think about mining as a way of compensating the miners for maintaining this public ledger.
But you said they weren't taking a cut. So if I have 50 Bitcoin and you and I, you're going to sell me an artwork, and I said, hey, I'll give you 50 Bitcoin for it. You said, sure, that's great. So I'm sending you my Bitcoin. Now a miner has to complete that transaction for us. Am I sending him some Bitcoin, or are you sending him some Bitcoin, or is there new Bitcoin being created, which therefore I would think somewhat devalues the currency a little bit every time that's done?
Yeah, so there is new Bitcoin being created. That's how Bitcoin sort of enters the supply of Bitcoin that's in circulation. But what's fascinating about Bitcoin is you said, you know, it does sort of, by increasing the supply of Bitcoin, it does put downward pressure on the value of Bitcoin. But it's all sort of driven by this protocol that was created at the origin of Bitcoin, so that the amount that they get paid is based on prevailing prices and volume. So it increases at this very sort of steady rate. And it is quite different than what we think of when we think about money like the U.S. dollar. So, you know, the other thing that's in the news is the Federal Reserve and all the monetary policy and monetary stimulus that they're providing, which is an increase in the supply of U.S. dollars, which also puts downward pressure on the U.S. dollar. So it's like any currency. The more you create, you are increasing supply. But Bitcoin does this through a mathematical code, whereas we have a central bank that manages that with people.
So overall, I think I can't remember if it was Buffett or somebody that were, you know, now they're throwing quotes around that Buffett, I think it was Buffett, says this is the craziest investment. It's not real. Don't, you know, get caught up in it. But for a lot of people, clearly it's been very valuable. How do you look at it, and how do you talk to your students about Bitcoin? Is it something to be scared of or wary of, that there's going to be this huge bubble that bursts and leaves a lot of people distraught? Or is it something to keep an eye on and maybe the future of currency?
Yeah, so you're right. Warren Buffett and others, Jamie Dimon at times, Bill Gates have been very skeptical of Bitcoin. And one reason Warren Buffett doesn't like it is it doesn't produce anything. So it's not like a stock that's producing future cash flow, and that the value of the stock is based on that future cash flow. So you could think of Bitcoin more as a commodity, which, you know, some people now refer to it as like digital gold. And, you know, why does gold have value? Well, it's, you know, it is a precious metal, but it doesn't really do anything. But part of why Bitcoin does have value is it does function as a form of money. You can transfer value from one person to another. So you can say it functions as a medium of exchange. It also does function as a store of value, which is the other key characteristic of money. So many people, for instance, in developing countries where their local currency is extremely volatile, or where they're seeing hyperinflation in countries like Venezuela, Bitcoin actually becomes the stable alternative. But for people in the U.S., you know, they look at Bitcoin prices and they see the volatility and they say, okay, well, I'm just going to stick with the dollar because it's clearly we've got low inflation, prices are much more stable. But that's part of why Bitcoin has started to take on more of the characteristics of a financial asset or an investment. You know, we're not really talking about buying pizzas and coffee with Bitcoin anymore. Most people, especially recently, are much more interested in it as kind of a speculative investment where they could make some money as Bitcoin prices may potentially rise. But as you pointed out, part of why we're talking about this tonight is that Bitcoin prices have again risen dramatically back up to 40,000 just recently. And it is not necessarily a time I would encourage your listeners to invest in Bitcoin. You know, prices have started falling again, and this does look a little bit like a pattern we saw last December 2017, where we saw a spike and then a following collapse. But I also, I think part of that pattern reflects digital innovation. You know, people are still trying to figure out, is this the future? And as more kind of assurance and belief in that builds, then prices rise. But then as people start to worry that, okay, maybe this isn't what I thought it was, then prices will fall. So, you know, what we've seen recently might be a short-term bubble. But I, you know, I do talk to my students about this. I teach money and banking, and I do talk about both the history of money and the future of money. And I think cryptocurrency is going to be a big part of that.
So when a texter from 773 writes, Bitcoin is really a scam, isn't it? You would say, no, it's not a scam. Just like, you know, our paper currency isn't a scam. It's hard for a lot of us not to look at this as like some weird Ponzi thing where, all right, we're going to buy Bitcoin. That's what we go, oh, the Bitcoin, yeah, that's not worth anything anymore. Oh, okay. I lost all my money. It really is hard to grasp if you're not on top of that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I, you know, I think it's understandable that people would be skeptical. I don't think this is something that you should just jump into, especially if your friends are saying, "Dude, you got to get in on this as an investment." You should be cautious about it. But I think it also comes down to kind of a philosophy or a perspective on life, because I think part of why some people trust U.S. dollar and cold hard cash is because it's just what we know. But if you think about like faith in the government, you know, is that on the rise or on the fall? And I'm not saying that the U.S. government is on the edge of collapse, but it is a human institution and there are people that are ultimately managing the value of the U.S. dollar. That's what central banks do. And I think for newer generations, there is this interest in a potential alternative. Like one way to think about Bitcoin, it is ungoverned money. And for some people that freaks them out because they want to know sort of who's behind this and who do I turn to when things go wrong. But for other people, that's precisely the appeal of it. It really is built on code, not on human institutions. And if you believe in the power of code, then that kind of transparency and neutrality can be very attractive.
Because it's not tied to a government or a part of the world, it's tied worldwide. So theoretically, as long as the world doesn't crumble, this theoretically should be less subject to politics or world events, things like that?
Totally. It is, you know, I think it is, digital currency has the potential to really become like global currency. Part of the attractiveness of it is, you know, you can transfer money across political borders without having to go through these massive transfer fees. You know, if you think about moving money from one account to another here in the U.S., you know, using Zelle or Venmo, that can seem very seamless. But as soon as you try and send money outside the country, then you realize how hard and how costly that is.
Yeah.
And Bitcoin can do that without, you know, it is borderless money.
Tell me a little bit about, I imagine you followed these stories. So Stephen Thomas, the guy in San Francisco who has 7,500, no, what he has 7,000 coins, digital coins, in a hard drive, some type of hard drive, must be a virtual, no, it's an actual hard drive because it does say he put it into a safe storage space now, some type of hard drive where if you use the wrong password 10 times, it will lock up forever. So he's used 8. He's got 2 left, and now he's locked it up because he's got over $200 million worth of Bitcoin on there. And then there's another guy who's got even more Bitcoin on a hard drive that he threw away back in 2013, and now he is offering Newport City Council, where he lives, 25% of the money to let him search the landfill to try to find the hard drive. Which is crazy to think that 7-8 years ago he threw away a hard drive and he thinks he's going to find it. And imagining it would be in any condition for him to retrieve it is probably a long shot. But I just don't know. What do you make of those stories? Is that? I mean, you know, we all have our money in banks and stuff like that. We're not responsible for it in the same way. And I guess a bank could fail. We have insurance up to a certain amount. We wouldn't have $200 million insured in Bitcoin at our local bank. So I guess something could go wrong with what we currently have, but our whole country is sort of built on it. So this is one of the protections you certainly don't have in the same way.
Yes, this is part of what makes Bitcoin different. And there are many other stories of people who have lost their Bitcoin or unable to access it. You know, there's estimates that as much as 20% of outstanding Bitcoin is inaccessible at this point.
They're saying $146 billion worth of Bitcoin, either lost or in a stranded wallet, whatever, people aren't going to access. $146 billion worth. And that will just be lost forever? I mean, that really will be? That's crazy to think about.
Yeah. It's hard to wrap the head around, but let me say a couple things about that. One is, you know, for you listeners who might be kind of concerned about this and think, well, this is a reason not to ever own Bitcoin. There are kind of two key alternatives. One is to own your own digital wallet, your own private key, which then sort of makes you the owner of the Bitcoin. And some people really like that because it is, as you said, kind of being your own bank. But it does expose you to the risk of losing that key, which is the problems that you're referring to. So many people have chosen to use what are called custodial accounts, where someone else sort of owns the Bitcoin on your behalf, sort of how we, many of us have, you know, stock accounts where we have a brokerage that holds the actual assets on our behalf. And so, you know, if someone's thinking about getting into Bitcoin but not sure how, they could go to Coinbase.com. And Coinbase is a Bitcoin exchange where you can buy Bitcoin, but you don't actually own that private key. They own it on your behalf. And so you can, you know, have a password, and they can help you retrieve that password in order to access your account at Coinbase. And so if people want that kind of additional layer of comfort and protection, it is available. So I don't want it to be that kind of stark alternative. But also, to explain one more time related to blockchain, so blockchain is a kind of two-layer technology. There's the public key and the private key. And so blockchain is extremely transparent in one sense because every digital wallet has a public key, and those public keys are publicly available, meaning that you can see money, Bitcoin, moving in and out of any digital wallet on the Bitcoin blockchain. But the private key is how you actually access that wallet. So it's It's these private keys that are getting lost. And then the trick is just to make sure that you store that private key in a way that you can access later and do so in a secure manner.
Lamont Black is an associate professor of finance in the Dryhouse College of Business at DePaul University here in Chicago. He mentioned Coinbase.com. They have a Learn tab there. I just got on it, where we can all try to do a little bit better understanding, and they have the beginner's guide to what is blockchain. So, Lamont, thank you so much for the information tonight. We really appreciate you being with us.
Thank you, Matt.